The Lord be with you.
Also with you.
We pray. O God, in the glorious transfiguration of your only begotten Son, you once confirmed the mysteries of the faith by the testimony of Moses and Elijah. And in the voice that came from the bright cloud, you wondrously foreshadowed our adoption by grace. Therefore, mercifully make us co-heirs with our King of his glory, and bring us to the fullness of our inheritance in the new heavens and the new earth. We ask it through Jesus Christ, our Lord, who lives and reigns with you and the Holy Spirit, one God, now and forever. Amen. All right, here is the reading Matthew thing, the piece of paper that you've come to know and love. So this is for what, last week, right? And I think maybe we'll just do it one more time. So I suppose through next Tuesday, right? And that way you won't feel compelled to read the Bible. I can. Lord knows we don't want to do that. So
just and no fraction.
Round down.
Yeah, I'm gonna. Right. I'm gonna round way down. 2.96 will become one. So, okay. Well, I thought maybe we could walk up to through the Passion narrative a bit, and then get up fairly quickly to 27:37, where group three, I think it is eager to translate. Of course, we're just kind of skipping over, so you'll just have to read and study Matthew for the rest of your life. There's really a remarkable change. I remember when it struck me, it kind of narratively reflects the already and the not yet, except it's the not yet and the already. That, however you understand the sheep and the goats, and we talked about that last time a bit, it's the consummation of the age, right? And the Son of Man is sitting on the throne of his glory, and he's just dividing everybody, because that's his role. And then without, you know, if you just kind of forget the fact that there are chapter numbers, right? Then you read at the beginning of chapter 26, and it happened when Jesus completed all these words, and you probably know that this formula occurs at the end of each of the major discourses, but Matthew here adds pantas, all. Right? So this is it. This is the end of the big-time teaching of Jesus. So the one who has just described himself as the judge of all says to his disciples, you know that after 2 days the Passover is happening, and the Son of Man is being handed over to be crucified. I mean, there is a contrast between the Son of Man and the Son of Man, right? So it's really a remarkable move, just like that. I wanted to invite you to just kind of a consideration of the concept of irony, which is a very slippery thing and is variously defined. Apparently there's a well-known song by a woman, female pop rock singer called, who is that person? Yeah, what's the name of the song? It's Ironic or something like that. Apparently somebody tells me that the things she mentions are not actually ironic. But my daughter, who's an English teacher, told me that. And she would know, I suppose, as a young person and as a person with an MA in English literature. But she, so there's no sort of agreed upon definition, but there are three things that generally show up when you talk about the concept of irony. That is, you have in the same account two levels of meaning. One is higher, the other is lower. Or you could say one is surface and the other is deeper. You can describe it any way you want. So you have two levels of meaning that are being signaled. The second feature of irony is that the two meanings are in conflict with each other, often in direct contradiction. And then does anybody know what the third sort of typical element, formal element of irony might be? Anybody studied English majors here? You have an innocent party. Innocent in the sense of they don't know what's going on. Not innocent, like morally innocent, but somebody who thinks they know what's happening, but they don't really. See? And often this will be the character, if you're telling a story, it will be the characters in the story who don't know what's going on, and the reader is privileged to know the bigger picture, and so you can actually see what's going on. You can read all of the Passion narratives in all four Gospels, and you can find lots and lots of irony. Now, the danger here is that once you start seeing it and enjoying it, as one scholar in the Gospel of John said, once you get into the thrill of the hunt for irony, you tend to fire your gun at anything that moves in the text. So, you know, I thought that was a good and funny way of saying it. But I wonder if Matthew, you know, Jesus predicts it, right, in verse 2. And then immediately the chief priests and elders, you know, they take counsel how they might destroy him. And they kept on saying, verse 5, not at the feast, lest there be a thoribos, a tumult, a riot, in or among the people. Now, that for me, verse 5 is actually key, because the nouns feast and tumult occur only twice in Matthew, and the other two times they occur is when Pilate has a custom at the feast to release one prisoner, and the chief. So they say. And they didn't just say it, but elegon, they kept on saying, imperfect. Not at the feast, no riot. See? So it's their plan, right? Well, guess what? It happens at the feast, and they make it happen because they cause a riot among the people. I mean, it's a pretty clear example of irony, Matthew is telling us, that there are two plans going on here. I mean, there's irony in the arrest scene. We'll maybe take a look at that very briefly, where Matthew actually gives us a narrative flashback where, you know, while he was still speaking, Judas and a great crowd appeared with swords and clubs from the chief priests. And then he says, now, Judas had given them a sign. So he actually, it's a flashback. See? So the one I kiss is he, arrest him. See? So the plan is working perfectly. But whose plan is it? See? And so you can actually read, you know, I think in a very valid way, because irony is a very ancient concept. It's extant in the Greek. It's commented on in even the old Greek comedies. It's in the Old Testament. I mean, there's been a lot of studies done in biblical literature. Socrates is kind of the first large-scale figure to be identified as ironic. So it's an ancient phenomenon. And again, it invites the reader into a kind of a, what shall I say, kind of a secret understanding with the narrator, you know, of what's really going on here. And I think it's eminently preachable, because we tend to think we know what's going on in our lives. I mean, we piously say we don't, but we pretend that we do. We live, in fact, most of the time that way, until something goes awry or something goes really well, surprisingly, and then we say, gee, I didn't plan that, you know. And lo and behold, the question remains, whose plan? Whose plan is it? So, Scott?
Would you think that Matthew actually writes this in a way that accentuates the irony, or do you think it's just the situation and the events make it be ironic? You know, I mean, the situation
yes.
is ironic.
Right.
Is he writing to make the irony that we see, or
I'm going to repeat the question because they couldn't hear you when they listened.
Oh,
but, no, it's okay. I don't want you to yell at the question. Is Matthew writing intentionally ironically, or are the events by nature ironic? I think the answer is actually both. That's a very good question. I mean, these events are intrinsically ironic. It would be hard to narrate them and not have irony in it, right? So I do think that Matthew at times is doing something on purpose, however. So anyway, I just wanted to begin by alerting you to that and inviting you to read ironically. You get a lot of this, and we'll get to some of this when we actually translate and then comment on the crucifixion scene. We have a fair amount of Greek to translate. Maybe just a couple of minutes. So you have this back and forthness of Jesus saying it, the chief priest planted, Jesus is anointed in Bethany, Judas goes out and makes a plan for 30 pieces of silver, and so forth. I think there's irony in the anointing scene at Bethany. You know, it's interesting. This Inhi Cho, who's working on her dissertation now, finishing it up this year, pointed this out to me. In verse 12, Jesus says, "For by throwing the myrrh, or by casting this myrrh upon my body, she has acted to prepare me for burial. En ta fiadzo. Now, you don't do that to anybody until they're dead already. Right? So the disciples are going, you know, what are you talking about? See, nobody knows what's going on. The woman didn't even know, probably, what she was doing. But Jesus knows. And there's so the theme of two plans and innocence, I think, is just kind of everywhere. So then we have the preparation for the upper room and the terrible scene with Judas, where he speaks differently. Verse 25. You know, Jesus says that one of you will betray me in verse 21. Then each one of the disciples asked the same grammatical question, expecting the answer no. Verse 22, mete ego eme curia. By the way, there's a good example of how ego eme is not the divine name, you know, by itself. I mean, it just isn't, you know. So, it is not I, is it, Lord? Remembering that in Matthew, disciples always address Jesus as Kyrios, always. Yeah. And then comes Judas, right, in verse 25. He asks the same question with the same grammar. Mete ego eme, Rabbi, Rabbi. This is also what Judas will say in the garden. Hail, Rabbi. Right? And so I do think, for instance, Scott, you're asking if Matthew is doing things deliberately. I think here's an example where he clearly is, right? And then Jesus enigmatically, for the first of three times, says, Su epos, you said. Nobody quite knows what to make of this. You know, it's a tone of voice problem. I can say it that way. What tone of voice is Jesus using when he says this? He says this to Judas. He says it to the high priest and to Caiaphas. He says it in the present indicative. You are saying, or you say. There are various guesses, and so you, again, this is not this is Bible class rather than sermon, right? I wonder if it's coming out of your mouth and you don't even hear what you're saying, right? So when the chief priest says, "Are you the Christ, the Son of God?" Jesus says, "You said." Again, you just have to guess. So when people ask you this question, say, tell them, "You've raised an important question, but we don't have time to go into it right now." which, as you know, means, I don't know. So.
You think that was better? I wouldn't want to, like, blow some fuse.
I guess you don't have fuses on the internet, though. Is that right?
So how often is the NIV translating it? Yes, it is you.
The NIV actually translates, yes, it is you? Are you kidding me? Don't be an NIV basher. But this is why we have you learn Greek and Hebrew. Really? Now, what do they do? What do they do at 6:64? Which is Jesus' response to Caiaphas. I think it's, it is as you say.
Yes, it is as you say.
It's the same Greek.
No, it's you yourselves have said it.
Well, bless their hearts. Yeah, yeah.
They
translated, yeah, huh, that's interesting. Well, that's not what it says. So, and that'll make you look smart, and you'll probably get a raise. So, no, you won't look smart, Mike, or you won't get a raise? Neither one. Okay, that's fine. That's fine. That's all right. Raises are somewhat overrated as long as you have food and a house. That's good. Then, we have the words of institution. It's hard to imagine, you know, just maybe one thought, how shocking that would have been in the first century. You know, they're doing Passover. They've done Passover their whole life, right? No, we don't actually know, by the way, what the first century Passover ritual looked like. You know, it's not, sometimes it's confidently asserted that we can reconstruct that, but that's simply not the case. The Jewish materials are too late to be confident about the particulars. And if you compare Matthew and Luke, you know, Luke has more cups and, you know, it's hard to figure that out. Nothing wrong. If you want to do a Seder meal, that's fine. I mean, I think that can be a good teaching tool if you want. But it's a common mistake that of thinking we can be too confident about what we actually knew was going on in the first century before the destruction of the temple. Destruction of the temple. Big deal. Right? So, Eric?
So we don't actually know if Judas was there either.
You know, strictly speaking, I don't think we can be sure. Because none of the, this is interesting. None of the synoptics tell us when Judas left. None of them do. They never say he left. All of a sudden, here he is in the garden with these soldiers, right? And John is the one who tells us when Judas left, but John does not give us the institution of the supper. Now, if Matthew and Mark, I think this is right, you can check it out yourself. If they have the historical order of like the sayings, when Jesus says, one of you will betray me, and the institution and so forth, if they're right, it looks like Judas is there. If Luke is historically accurate, it looks like Judas isn't there. If you try to mash those up with John, see? Because Matthew and Mark have one kind of order of clumps of sayings of Christ, and Luke has a slightly different order, see? So it's actually a problem that I think is ultimately insoluble. Is that a word? Insoluble? Not able to be solued? Right.
He's not able to be resolved.
Yeah, okay, good. Okay, chemist or scientist or no, just a literate person. Thank you, Carl. I feel slightly less intelligent than I did a while ago. So no raise for me, I guess. I don't think we can be sure, to be honest, and so people can't draw implications for Eucharistic practice today about the fact that Judas was there. I mean, that's kind of an invalid approach anyway, I think. If that were the case, you should only admit people who had no idea that Jesus was going to suffer and die, and this was a good and that this was a good idea. I mean, so. Now, the terrible feature, one of the terrible, but again, so this amazing gift, completely, can you imagine to a Jew, drink this is my blood? I mean, think about that. I mean, that would have to have been offensive or something. You know, you're not supposed to drink any blood. But for Jesus to say, this is my blood, I mean, that's, you know, I hope this doesn't offend anybody. That's a very terrible and weird thing for Jesus to say. So did they know what was going on? I don't get it. I don't see it, you know, but that's okay. In a sense, they never knew precisely what Jesus was up to anyway. So, I'm quite happy to point out in verse 29 the sort of the eschatological anticipation that's intrinsic to the supper, and this is why we call it the foretaste of the feast to come, right? So, I say to you, I will certainly not from now drink from this fruit of the vine until that day when I drink it with you in a new way in the reign of my Father. I don't think this can be argued as a reference to the Eucharistic fellowship post-Easter, because I don't think we would or should say that Jesus drinks with us. Right? See, Jesus is not drinking the Eucharist with us. Right? So, and the easy way to refer to understand this, I think, is that it refers to the fact that many will come from east and west, right, and sit at table with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the kingdom of the Father in chapter 13. No, chapter 8. So, which you know because you've read Matthew more times than you actually wanted to. Isn't that great? See, you were cursing me just last week for this, but when I don't get a raise, you're going to send me money. Or maybe not. Look at the terrible words of 31 to 35. I think one of the reasons these are here is so that we'll be able to interpret how badly the disciples perform later. And it functions to strip away every other human figure and to leave Christ alone, which is just right. verse 31, then Jesus says to them, all of you will be caused to stumble because of me on this night. Remember 11:6, blessed is the one who is not caused to stumble because of me. Right? They won't be blessed that night, for it is written, I will strike the shepherd, and the sheep of the flock will be scattered. But after I am raised, I will go ahead of you into Galilee. Peter, doesn't get it. He answered and said to him, if all are caused to stumble because of you, I, emphatic pronoun, I, never will be caused to stumble. It's hard to be quite that wrong, but Jesus said to him, truly I say to you, that on this night before the rooster sounds, "You will deny me three times." But Peter says to him, "Check the irony in this. Even if it is necessary for me to die with you." What's not? But Peter doesn't know anything. Right? "I will certainly not." Ume plus the aorist subjunctive. "I will certainly not deny you." Hamoios kai pontes hoi mathetai apon. "Likewise also all the disciples said." Say, Peter is just a representative here. Right? They're all the same. So, Pat? Yeah, imagine that.
I wonder how necessary it was for everyone else to follow away. If we take the Jesus of Israel boil down to one.
That's a very good question. What do you think? How the question is, how necessary is it for everyone to fall away if Jesus is actually Israel reduced to one?
And I think it is very necessary.
Yeah. I think so. Because he dies as the Son of God, right? "This is my beloved Son. Listen to him." We heard in chapel today. "If you are the Son of God, come down now. Let God delight in him, for he said, I am the Son of God." Yeah, I think Jesus is dying as the people, as the substitute for the people.
I don't want to take it so far. That's not sufficient. I don't want to take it so far to say we're keeping him in the nature of God.
Right. Right, right. No, I think if you just read the narrative, you can say, again, what happens is that everyone strips away, so the only one you're left with is the true Son. That's exactly right. Right. No, that's a good observation. I think you're right. So, and then the terrible agony of Jesus in the garden, I guess I was going to say nicely, appropriately, we're coming up on Lent, starting tomorrow, Ash Wednesday. And the mystery of the obedient son. Again, you could spend lots and lots of time. Verse 46, "Arise, let us go. Behold, the one who is betraying me has come near." And the arrest scene. Nothing happens till Jesus gives the word. And then two disparate plans are revealed. One is the plan of the unnamed disciple. John, of course, tells us it's Peter. But you haven't been reading John this term, I trust. And that would be confusing, actually, to take Matthew and John in the same term. Is that what you've been doing? Yeah. Josh is saying, "Verily, verily, I don't know what I'm reading." There's a couple guys that really... Oh, that's excellent. That is excellent. Well, I thought you guys were looking kind of cosmic. John is very cosmic. You know, I'm a synoptic guy. I get confused when I read John. Because everything means everything. Well, it does. It's like Velcro. You know, everything's attached. You can't possibly trace out one distinct theme in John. You know, it's just all kind of... Which is why it appeals to a guy like Shuker, and I certainly mean that as a compliment. So put your sword away, right? This is the equivalent of, in John, this other gospel that some of you have been reading, Jesus says, "My kingship is not of this world. If it were, my followers would fight." See, that I think that verse is sometimes read, "My kingship is like floating up in the sky or something." But "of this world" means it doesn't come by means of force. It comes, in fact, by means of death, right? The opposite of force. Right? And so this is, in a sense, an equivalent for that. So, and then, of course, it's interesting. Look at what Jesus says to those who were... he continues to speak to the disciples, or to that unnamed disciple. "Do you think, verse 53, that I am not able to call upon my Father, and he will present to me now more than 12 legions of angels? I don't need 12 measly disciples," right? If that's the way it's supposed to work, I don't need your help. But that's not the way it's supposed to work. How then are the scriptures fulfilled that thus it must happen? Right? So, and then in his words to the crowds, it's the same thing. They think they're carrying out a plan. He says, "As against a thief, did you come out with swords and sticks to seize me? No, I mean, there's not a no in the text, but he says, day by day in the temple I used to sit teaching, and you didn't arrest me. If you were just after a lay stase, you could have done it any time. That's not why you're here. Why you're here is verse 56. This whole thing has happened that the scripture of the prophets might be fulfilled. That's what's going on. Right? And then, again, a terrible statement, verse 56. Then all the disciples forsook him and fled. Right? Peter follows at a distance, which doesn't bode well for him, of course, and he falters and falls later. Just a few verses. The trial before the Sanhedrin. Jesus is rejected for his answer. Again, the somewhat enigmatic su apos in verse 65, for you said. He's accused of blasphemy, condemned, right? Peter denies. It's strike one, strike two, strike three. Literally, if you read 69 to 75 carefully, he's out, he goes farther out, he goes all the way out. I mean, it's narrated. It's strike one, strike two, strike three. And then we have the trial before Pilate. The only word that Jesus says is to him, it's you are saying it in verse 11. We have the suicide of Judas, of course, the terrible thing. And then the asking for Barabbas. And the mocking and the movement out to crucifixion, to the place called Golgotha in verse 33. And that kind of brings us to 37. So, questions, a few questions about this amazing material. Kevin?
In verse 58 of 26,
yes.
Peter is the only disciple who follows.
Mm-hmm. Well, yes, although he follows from a distance.
Right.
Yeah. Right. Oh, I think so. Yeah. He said, Jesus didn't say, follow me from a distance.
Right.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. And again, Peter is representative. Remember here. You know, you will all. Peter said, I will never. They all said the same thing. See, so Peter is actually just representing the 12 here. So, now, this is interesting. I don't want to get into this because I haven't figured out how to say this. But I think, I'll just tell you what I think, but I don't really want to get into it. I think that Peter apostatizes. He actually falls from faith, see? And so does Judas, of course. I mean, we have Peter, and then they hand Jesus over to Pilate, and then we have Judas. So Jesus is right in the middle, you know. Now, what's interesting to me is how much resistance I get from both pastors and lay people when I suggest that Peter actually falls from faith. They say that, no, he held on, or he was just afraid, or something. Here's my guess. My guess is that for decades, people have been told in Lenten sermons, you're just like Peter. Right? I mean, you know. And if that's the case, well, that's not a very comforting notion to say that Peter fell from faith. Right? Now, the fact of the matter is, in one sense, we're not just like Peter, right? Just like at the denial when he rebukes Jesus in 16, right? I've never yet once thought that would have been a bad idea for Jesus to suffer and die and rise from the dead. I think that's a great idea, see? Now, you make a theological connection because the sin that lives in me, you know, obviously leads to the same place unless it's repented of and so forth and so on. But I wonder if that's why. I hit this in my Bible class at church last Sunday. It was really remarkable. One very well-grounded, well-informed, very smart, well-educated Missouri Synod layperson said, no, Peter was just afraid. He just kind of chickened out, but he was really still kind of in there with Jesus. It was just really interesting. I said, they thought he was dead. He didn't rise from the dead. Yeah, I know that, but da-da-da-da-da. See, the women come to the tomb. They think Jesus is still dead. Even the disciples in John in the upper room, no, they're still believers. They think Jesus is dead and he's not going to rise. I call that unbelief. So anyway, I'll just warn you. You know, it's not a hill worth dying on. It's an exegetical point, you know. But it's just interesting. I keep hitting this, and now it's Lent again. It's Series A, so I've been hitting it again recently. So, Kevin, and then Mark.
How does that enjoy the major single section thing to be false that we were to do all the way and we deny the same word?
Yeah. Well, just stay in Matthew chapter 10. Whoever denies me before man, I will deny before my Father in heaven. Right. Now, Peter is restored. Of course he's restored. Right. But that's the point. He's restored. He's not just sort of patched up. If I can say it that way. So, yeah, Mark.
Strange one. We can kick it to next week. 26:29, it talks about the island up that the fruit of vine.
Yeah.
And that could be part of our translation today. The guy goes into sponge with wine and vinegar.
Oh, okay.
Is wine vinegar not wine? Is that a valid smash up?
That's a good thing. Thanks for asking another question I've never thought of. I don't know. Yeah, maybe it's with you. Maybe that would be the difference. He says to the disciples, I will not drink it with you until. Yeah.
But
I don't know.
He doesn't say he drank it, he just was with it.
Yeah, right. Right.
One more temptation that's on that field.
That you've raised an important point, but we don't have time to go into it right now. So, great. I feel fairly successful as a teacher right now. What did I do? I forced you to read the Bible. Scott and then Mark.
In relation to this, understanding that Peter fell away just as Judas fell away, is Peter again just a spokesman for the rest of the disciples?
Mm-hmm.
Do we want to go ahead and say that the rest, when they fled from him, and they fell away also?
You will all be caused to stumble because of me this night. That's what he says. I will strike the shepherd, and the sheep of the flock will be scattered.
And we just don't happen, because of the narratives, to see them restored.
Yeah.
They wouldn't have been restored, obviously.
Like I will go ahead of you into Galilee. That's a great promise. Right. And then go and tell my brothers, right? Chapter 10, where they grab Jesus' feet, right? I mean chapter 28:9-10, right? Yeah, no, you kind of really need Easter. We'll talk about that. Okay. You know. Yeah. Mark, you had a comment.
Yeah. Did you make anything of the fact that
probably
Jesus no, it's going to fall into the mark.
Probably not.
Jesus answers Pilate in 27:11.
Yeah.
Does not answer the Jews then. Immediately thereafter, he turns back on the Jews at that point.
I've never thought about it. I just think the scene has changed. I will say that I think the terrible verse 25 is ironic. And, of course, it has at times over the history of the church been made into a cause for anti-Semitism. I mean, of terrible sorts. His blood be upon us and upon our children. You know, the Jews being Christ killers and that terrible nonsense. This generation upon whom all the righteous blood will come was that generation. See, that one. Not all of them. That one. See? And the cry of the people is ironic, just like everything else is ironic. You know, I am innocent of this man's blood. I don't think so. What do you mean? I've actually had guys argue in exegetical studies that Pilate was actually exonerated. What are you talking about? He's the Roman governor. He can do anything he wants, and he knows Jesus is innocent, right? I am innocent of the blood of this man. Give me a break. Did I mention I think that's ironic? Yeah, and then the people say, his blood be upon us and upon our children. Well, this is the blood which is being poured out for the forgiveness of sins. See? So the irony is that it actually is for them, although they don't want it, right? But you see how that takes the cry and it really turns it in a very different direction, you know? It means that the salvation that Jesus has accomplished, and by the way, now I'm leaning on in He Chose work, is actually a universal salvation. It is even for those enemies who kill Him and reject Him, right? So, yeah, but that there's been apparent, I've never studied this thoroughly, but there's been some terrible use of that verse over the course of the last two millennia, I guess. Okay, now we get to verse 37. So we should translate some Greek, and we'll just do this in good order. And is it for now, countrymen, Leonbar, Pek, Volta, Torni, and Bugeser? Is that right? You guys look ready. I thought it was you. Okay, I don't know, Josh, why don't you get us started on verse 37? Yeah, go ahead.
And they placed over his head his garment that ran as if Jesus became a Jew.
Okay. What kind of a genitive do you think his charge would be? The charge of him? I think so. I tell my, they charged him. And then we have this participle, which is in predicate position, right? Gegramenein. Could you find, I can't, by the way, a natural predicate position translation that works? Or did you just, how did you take it, Josh? With what now? Sorry, say again.
I just said.
Oh, which read?
Yeah.
Yeah, see, what you're doing there is you're taking it as, what does Wallace call this, an adjectival? I think you have to go that way. Again, it's a predicate position participle, clearly. But sometimes, Vels, I think, calls this supplementary. Jack Kingsbury used to call this necessary part of the object of the verb. I mean, it's, the context, it just doesn't allow for a normal adverbial kind of translation. So we'll just take it as almost as if it were attributive, right? Position. See, that would work. They put it over his head, his charge, after it had been written. I mean, that doesn't sort of contradict anything. So, yeah, that's a possibility. But I think, again, the grammars I looked up kind of listed as one of these supplementary things. But that means you're working with the categories well. Like, so, Adam?
I just think that it's written. Like, it's placed on the head, it's charge, written.
Uh-huh. Well, that's a way of remaining agnostic on the grammatical point. So that's fine. Especially since you're not in group number three. Right? Or are you? You are in group number three. All right, well, I would encourage you to make a decision of one sort or another. So, yeah. I don't actually remember if I asked you this, but there are two pages to the quiz. So. And you get 3 pages this time, because you just had one last time. That's right, yeah. Mark? Well, you'd need it with a form of amen. Yeah, see, it's all, well, now what we're doing is we're realizing that our grammatical categories don't always fit, right? That's right. Thank you very much. Now, the one thing that did occur to me, that sometimes when you have several adjectives stringing along after a noun, sometimes you will not have the article repeated where you'd expect it. That was the one thing that occurred to me, because we have tein aitean, then we have autu, and then we have gegramenon. See? So sometimes, if it's far enough away, an article that you might expect to be there simply will drop out. But that's just another guess. So, and then the charge is easy enough grammatically. This one is Jesus in apposition, the King of the Jews. What kind of genitive would that be? Just King of the Jews. Objective, sure, why not? He rules the Jews, right? He does. He rules everybody. But Pilate certainly doesn't believe it. So, good. No questions on 37? All right. Troy, why don't you do 30, maybe 38 and 39 for us?
Okay. I guess this is historic present.
So it is historical present.
There were crucified with him two bandits, one on the right hand and one on left, or the left.
Yep.
Then the passers-by began to use or vilify him, shaking their heads.
Good, dot, dot, dot. Right. Good. Yeah, historical present there. I don't know if you need to supply there, let's see, there were crucified two thieves. I think you can just make duo laced by the subject. Okay. Don't you think? Two thieves were crucified.
Okay.
Yeah. And this odd, it looks odd to us, the plural idiom, out of the rights and out of the lefts, that's just the way it's said, you know. An inceptive, imperfect, I think, began to blaspheme, which works well at the beginning of the scene. What do you think about canuntus, Troy? How did you take that? It's predicate position with those passing by as the referent. So began to blaspheme him.
But, in terms of doing any sort of bootkeeping or something,
okay.
Like that, I didn't really see how it would make sense. I guess I just took that from the imperfect. I kind of
yes, yes.
Borrowed the inceptive idea.
Mm-hmm. Right. And yes, and but then in terms of resolving the participle, if it's predicate position, anybody in also in group three do something more specific with it? I'm sorry? Yes, although that doesn't fit Wallace's category very well. I don't know. I thought it was means. This is how they were blaspheming. By shaking the head, I don't exactly know what that means. You know, is this some sort of physical gesture of derision? You know, like, oh, you know. It was when I was did a quarter of CPE long ago, I discovered that different socioeconomic and sort of subcultural groups grieved in radically different ways. Because I was assigned to the County General Hospital in Houston, Texas, so Ben Taub Hospital in the Texas Medical Center, so all the indigent blunt trauma stuff came to our ER, you know. And I was a chaplain for 2 weeks on the ER, you know. That was there were some aspects of Vicarage that I wasn't scared of, you know, after that. And so I wonder if there's a culturally specific gesture here. What does it mean to shake the head, see, and say, you who destroy the temple, something like that. So, but yeah, I think you could take it temporally as they shook their head, as they were shaking their head, something like that. But I like means, actually, the way Dan suggested.
Doesn't Wallace have a category like right next to
means? Yeah, I don't know what the difference is between means and manner. Yeah, I'd be happy with either one. You know, but you're not even in group number three, are you? You just care about the word.
So,
good man. Good. Any questions? Good translation? And not too bad? Matthew's Greek isn't actually too bad most of the time. Paul is harder, right? Hebrews is a nightmare. Josephus is impossible. Okay, verse 40, maybe 40 and 41. Carl, could you do this for us, please? Thank you.
When you just said the thing, you had you who would destroy, is there anywhere you get that you? Where did you supply that?
Oh, there's always a reason for what I do.
Because I have a really awkward translation.
Yeah, no, that's okay. It is kind of awkward. Just go for it and we'll, okay. Yeah.
And saying, the one who would destroy the temple and in 3 days rebuild, save yourself if you are a son of God and come down from the cross. Likewise, also the chief priests mocking with the scribes and elders began saying.
Okay, good, good. I mean, your translation is a good one, Carl. It's just that the imperative is second singular, right? So son. So I don't know how else in English to reflect that. So they seem to be talking to Jesus, right? So, but there is no vocative of the article, if I can say it that way. So I don't know how you'd say a vocative substantized participle, which is what we have here, you know. So, I think your translation is a good translation. So, yeah. Yeah, it is awkward in English, right? The one who destroys the temple and in 3 days builds. By the way, this is when you have article, substantive, chi, substantive. Anybody? What's that called? Oh, man, you guys worked hard. Sharpe's rule. Thank you very much. It means that kata luon and oikodemon refer to the same person, which is not too hard in this context. You kind of know it anyway. But yeah, if you have an article, it's too hard to explain. Well, it's not too hard to explain. Article, noun, chi, noun, right? Or noun equivalent, right? And if the nouns are singular, if they refer to persons and they're not proper names, and you're thinking, Gads, why does he know this? Then you invoke Granville Sharpe's rule. And it refers to the same person. There's a couple of Christological passages, actually. I mean, this actually matters. Titus 2, our great God and Savior, Jesus Christ. Not many times when Jesus is actually called Theos in the Bible. It's about 6 or 8. So. And all it means is that both nouns, Granville Sharp's rule indicates that both nouns, or there can be actually more than two, but typically it's a pair, they refer to the same person. That's the payoff. Now, in this context, it's pretty obvious, right? So there isn't much payoff. Other than to cause Adam slight consternation, right? So. Carl, I'm just going to have to chastise you on this one, buddy. If you are a son of God, there's another rule that we can invoke on this one. Anybody got this one? Caldwell's rule. Yeah. Now, you're right. There's no article on son, right? But Caldwell's rule suggests the following. If in context you decide that a noun is definite, not indefinite, you know, the, not a, in context you decide it, and you discover that that noun, excuse me, let me start over. If in context you discover that a predicate nominative is definite, not indefinite, and you discover that that predicate nominative precedes the linking verb in word order, Gesundheit, then you realize that the normal pattern is for the definite predicate nominative to lack the article. And of course, the big passage where this pays off is, anybody? John 1:1. Oh, you're in John. Some of you are in John, right? You know all about Caldwell's rule then, right? By the way, if you want to see a great illustration of Caldwell's rule in John, I think this is right, John 8:12 and John 9:5. I am the light of the world, I am the light of the world. See? With one of them, so it's linking verb, I am light is the predicate nominative. With one, it follows the linking verb and has the article. With the other one, I don't remember which one, it precedes the linking verb, and guess what? It doesn't have the article. Okay. So in context, you probably, given the trial and all that stuff, you'd probably say contextually, okay, this is probably not a son, but the Son of God. And you go, Caldwell's rule, for crying out loud. And then your wife goes, shut up. Right? Take out the garbage. Or whatever. And come down from the cross. Likewise also the chief priests, as they mocked with the grammarians and the elders, began to say, kept on saying something like that. And then we'll get their discourse in a second. Questions about 40 and 41? Good work by group 3. Adam, take us to 42 and 43, man.
He saved others, and I will save himself. He is king of Israel. Let him come down now from the cross, and we will believe in him. He believes in God. Let him save him now, if he wants him. For he said, let of God, I am the Son.
Okay, good. Yeah, again, it's context, right? Right. Here, although, never mind. We'll come to that in a second. I think, let's see, do we have an article? I'm looking at the variant reading in verse 42. No, it's not the article. He is a king of Israel? Maybe the king of Israel? Just from context, right? Let him come down now from the cross, and we will believe on him. Well, I think in context, probably the, it's not a big point. I mean, Israel doesn't have more than one king at a time, right? Mark?
Would that be a question? That's all the others here said, that isn't going to be the king of Israel he is. Let him now come down from the cross.
Well, it could be. I mean, you know, it could be punctuated as a question. Is he the king of Israel? You mean that kind of thing?
Yeah.
Or would you prefer the Yoda translation?
They're mocking.
The king of Israel he is? You know?
They're mocking.
They are indeed. They are indeed mocking him.
There's that sign up there that says that's what he
exactly
is.
Right. That's exactly right.
It really is. Okay.
Right.
There's more of a denial than a question. Actually, I think the illuminated principle would be, was
Yeah, well, I think you might write this down. I think it's ironic. Yeah, right. Oh, yeah, I mean, the irony here is so thick you can cut it with a knife. It's hard to keep track of it all, right? So, and we will believe on him. Psalm 22, as you know, is all over the passion narrative, right? So in verse 43, he trusted in God, let him rescue him now. If he wants him, is close to Psalm 22, verse 9. Well, God does actually want him. I mean, after all, he is his beloved son, in whom he is well pleased. But he won't rescue him. That's not the plan. For he said, I am. Now, here the word order is a little unusual, right? There's no article on anything. But again, the context would probably lead you. Remember that, and this is hard because when you first learn Greek, you call, you know, ha, he, ta, the definite article. But the problem is the Greek doesn't have what? An indefinite article. So Greek just has an article, and that's why it gets confusing. It doesn't always. Excuse me. Save those fuses. It doesn't always play out nicely. Context, you know. And Wallace has like 8,700 different ways the article can function. You know. So he's probably a very nice guy. Well, he is a nice guy. I've talked to him. Really smart. And text critic before he went into grammar. So maybe Chloe then will go into grammar, huh? So go Cubs. Yeah, Mark?
Yeah, I'm having a tough time understanding where we get if from in verse 4.
Well, I don't see it. Did we say if?
Yeah, he said if. And
who said if? Adam said if?
Adam.
Well, why did you say if?
I said if because it seems like they're questioning.
Can you feel the footsteps of doom approaching? You can't just make up stuff for crying out loud.
No,
I'm just kidding.
You haven't got a name for it. Why don't we call it text?
We could. Pex rule. I still remember my first year here. I was absolutely unbearable, I'm sure. Worse than I am now. And, you know, I'm fresh out of graduate school, so I'm going to turn everybody into a Greek grammarian, you know. And one guy who's a good friend still and will remain unnamed in this context, I was asking him to translate something. And he just, yeah, you know, I mean, he's a good pastor. He just wasn't very good at Greek. And I said, well, why do you translate it that way? He says, well, I just figured if you were Lutheran, you'd know how to translate it. He actually said that. And I think he meant it, you know. He probably doesn't remember that, but it's first year of teaching, you know. So I also remember the first time I was a guest instructor, I decided we'd start with some Greek review. And so I wrote a participle on the board, and I turned around to like six students in the summer of 1991. I said, what's that? I was scared to death, you know. They were like a cow looking at a new gate. And I thought to myself, well, at least I know more than they do. I don't think there's if in there. It's a statement. Or maybe a question. Yeah, no, it can be punctuated as a question. Are you the king? Is he the king of Israel? Say. But Peck's rule does definitely not apply here.
Well, then, so I'm stumped as to how it should be translated. I mean, it seems like it should be, you know.
Well, he's the king of Israel.
Right, no.
No. Well, in a minute. Let him come down.
So wouldn't it be second person? And wouldn't
he... Well, he's the king of Israel, third person singular. So now they're talking to one another. And then the...
Then wouldn't it be an imperative?
Well, katabato is an imperative.
Oh, it is. Okay.
Uh-huh. Yeah. That's okay. Gibbs's rule. Gibbs's rule is if I can't figure something out, I have to go back and reparse. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, the toe ending. Yeah, yeah, so he's the king of Israel. Let him come down now. That is actually addressed to, it's an imperative and it's third person, so in English we can't do it very well. Right. Adam, you want to defend your inadequate translation?
Ties can be taken not as an and, also, but as a then. And
if, yes?
And if they're saying, well, then you will believe, then the first part would naturally be an if statement.
Now, which is the first part then?
Well, the first part immediately would be letting him down from the cross.
So, if he comes down from the cross.
But they're making the assumption that because he's the king of Israel, that he'll be able to come down from the cross. And then they would leave.
Right. Well, I will give you this. I'll give you two things, actually. You're right. There are a lot of structures which sort of semantically are not far away from a conditional sentence in terms of the force and the if-then, you know. So you're right about that. And you're also right. And by the way, I'm very happy to point out my favorite paragraph in Blosterberger Funk. It's paragraph 442, which shows you in terms of the paratactic nature of New Testament Greek, where you've got clause, chi, clause, you've got ties, that like the vav in Hebrew, it can sort of express result. Or in this case, actually, to be honest, Mark does not have chi and we will believe in him. He has hina in order that. So I think that's a good observation as well, that sometimes a chi clause that follows can, and it's purely context. It's not just linking another item. Maybe it's expressing a result or even a purpose. So you're absolutely right. It can do that. But again, I'd rather not, you know, just like supply words.
So, actually, the apparatus very
reading. I know. The apparatus has it. That's right. So first you'll have to defend the variant reading. So go talk to Chloe. Whatever. But actually what that does is that it shows what Adam is thinking is not far from what some ancient Greek type dead people were thinking. So that's good. Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, go ahead and then Mark.
My other question was, and this is probably a little broader than just this verse, but the idea of believing in him.
Yes.
How do you best render that, and what does that mean? Yeah, I think we often just say,
"Yeah, right."
Is it on him or
well,
in him or
yeah. I don't know off the top of my head. See, I have some notes with me. I might have it, conceivably. There are different constructions possible after pistuo. Okay. It can take a dative noun or pronoun. John's typical construction. Those of you in John. Pistuo, anybody? Ace or ice plus the accusative. That's John's typical way of saying it. I don't know. That's the question is you'd have to, I don't think I have the any of that information here. Well, actually, Blosterbinder Funk 187.6 notes the idiom of trust summoned with the dative, or rather often with various prepositional phrases. See, so again, but the fact of the matter is there is a kind of a fluidity in how to say it. I think that, because they're saying the truth, but they don't know it. You know, what they're saying, oh yeah, we'd believe in him if he were to come down. Ho, ho, ho. So notice I slipped into the if construction, which again shows semantically what you were suggesting is not far off at all. So I don't think there's any grammatical distinction, though, between a p after pistuane and maybe some other prepositional phrase. There's just a kind of a grammatical fluidity there. Yeah. We say in, believe in. And to us, that means more than just maybe believing someone. But I don't think the Greek reflects that. John himself even has a variety of ways of saying this. So, Mark, you were waiting, and then Mike.
Yeah, the clause at the end of 43.
Yes.
Is this an example of what Locke calls the recitative clause in direct discourse? Where he says you can drop the R and just translate.
Yes.
He said, I'm sorry.
Yes. Yes, it is. Hati recitative is simply hati to introduce direct discourse, not indirect. Yep. And you know it's direct because it's I. If it were indirect, it would be, for he said that he was the Son of God. Right. Yep. Good. I should have asked that on a quiz. Let me write that down. Just kidding. I'll put it on yours. Yeah.
Can
I have extra
credit?
No, absolutely not. Virtue is its own reward, pal. Okay, Pat.
Does it say something to get theologically about faith and believing that Jesus didn't come up with that?
Yeah.
And I know it's extra math, but the idea of the poor man in heaven and the rich man in hell thing keeps popping in mind. That even if somebody did come back from the dead, they wouldn't believe.
Yeah.
And here, even if Jesus did come off the rock, they still wouldn't believe.
Well, that would be true, although, again, I think, well, yeah, that, yeah, I mean, I just, that's right. I'm getting lost in the levels of irony there for just a second. Most of it's because my head's filled with various levels of mucus. So, yeah, I had not thought of that. So, okay, and now we need verse 44, and it's Anthony.
To him also the robbers who were crucified with him repeatedly insulted.
Okay, good. Now that was a creative... Was it like a special Italian translation, Anthony? The first one, to him? That was great. I don't think I've ever heard that before. So, let's see. How do I do this without making it too painful? Let's see. Explain that one for me there, brother. To him, man, that's great. Ta au ta, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I don't
remember. They're listening to this on the internet and they're thinking, man, I don't know. Well, probably ta au ta. Now, again, this is au ta is the neuter singular, probably accusative, could be nominative, personal pronoun, right? When it's got an article, when it's an attributive position, it means what? Ta au tas, ta au ta. Anybody? This means the same, right? It's like ha aner au tas, the man himself, ha au tas aner, the same man. This makes Vels happy when he comes at you. You say ha aner au tas. Means the man himself, because there the pronoun is in, sorry Carl, predicate position. Okay, yeah, and you want to make Dr. Vels happy. He's the dean of the faculty and a great person. So literally, it's simply the same thing, but it's accusative, right? So somebody help me out here grammatically. We've seen it before. You'll make me a happy man if you can get this. Ben, you got this? You're just kind of wiping that one eye. Yeah, that's cool. Okay. Anybody? Group three? Well, what do our English translations do? How do they render it at the beginning of the verse? Give me what they do with ta-au-ta.
In the same
way. How do they get there? It just means the same thing. It's the adverbial accusative of reference. That's exactly right. It's an adverbial accusative. It's in the grammars. I'm not making this up. We've seen this before. The accusative, the same thing. With respect, with reference to the same thing. That's how you translate it. Older Greek loves to use accusative nouns or pronouns. And this is acting like a noun because it's got the article. It loves to use it as adverbs. See, New Testament does it less often. Likes to use datives more often, actually. But yeah, this happens, and that's how you can get in the translations in the same way. It's smoothing out with reference to the same thing. Okay? So, also, and notice how there the witnesses, the blasphemers, all line up, right? It's three imperfects. E blasphemun in 39. And then elegon at the end of 41. And now onedidzon at the end of 44. It's not just they said or blasphemed. They began, they kept on, right? The thieves who had been crucified with him. And of course, we don't have the repentant thief in Matthew. So if you're preaching on this text, you probably wouldn't include a reference to the repentant thief. So just because he's not there. Questions? In the same way. That was great. So now we have Peck's rule, and we have the Italian version. So that's great. That's great. That's good. All right. Let's press forward. Mark, would you take us through 45 and 46, please?
Now, from the sixth hour, darkness came upon all the land until the ninth hour. And about the ninth hour, Jesus cried out by a loud voice.
What was that? I mean, I just saw a flash over there.
Oh, was it really?
Yeah.
Oh, got it. Yes.
Now, just tell me it wasn't on purpose.
They brought me in for special effects.
Okay. We used to do a tenebrae service where you close the book at the end. You ever seen? Yeah, yeah. The biggest book I had was my Greek concordance, so I had to do that with a Greek concordance every year. Boom. So. Okay, carry on then, Mark.
And about the ninth hour, Jesus cried out by a loud voice, saying, "My God, my God, why have you forsaken me?" That is, "My God, why did you forsake me?"
Right, right, good. Good, nice translation. You took voice, great voice as dative of means, it sounded like to me. The variant readings are a mess on the cry of dereliction, which is here and in Mark, of course, not Luke or John. Eli, if the editors are correct, what you have here is a mixture of Hebrew, transliterated Hebrew, and transliterated Aramaic. Eli would be simply "my God" in Hebrew. Mark has in the Nestle Aleph Eloi, which would be Aramaic. Lema, Sabachthani, is Aramaic. It's not Hebrew. So, and the mess, I think, is simply caused by scribes over the centuries that don't know either Hebrew or Aramaic. So they're just copying words and they're trying to figure out what to write. But it doesn't matter because... and by the way, the issue of the languages of Palestine is kind of an interesting historical issue. Hebrew is a live language. It's debated as to in what contexts it would be used. Is it just for religious purposes, you know? Aramaic is the common dialect in the area, and we have, for instance, the Targums. You guys heard of the Targums? Which are Aramaic paraphrases, homiletical expansions of the Old Testament. And then Greek, given the influence of Alexander for centuries. So it's completely possible. I think I'm just completely relying on skimming the works of others, that Christ and others were trilingual in some sense. But it's a very fluid phenomenon. So in what language did Jesus actually speak the cry of dereliction? If he's quoting the Hebrew Psalter, then he'll have simply said it in Hebrew. But he may as well have said it in Aramaic. So, and then St. Matthew, of course, translates, "My God, my God." Because of what, right? In order for what? Why did you forsake me? So, great mystery, of course, Carl.
How many times did they make a quote like that actually translated from what he actually spoke, as opposed to saying he's quoting Psalm 22, just translated in Septuagint?
Right.
Yeah. It seems kind of odd that they would actually write down
Right. Literally
the exact.
Right. Carl, doing this for the sake of the recording, has asked how often you get transliterated Hebrew Aramaic. Mark has this about 8 times, I think. For instance, Ephatha, you know, Talitha Kumi, little girl arise, and so forth. Matthew doesn't have it. I'm trying to remember. This might be the only time. Can anybody think of another time when you get...
Raka?
Okay, Raka, yeah, is probably an Aramaic word, right. Good example. You guys have been reading the Bible, haven't you? It's nice to look at about 35 guys and say, what does Matthew say? You guys actually know. So it is unusual. Mark seems to have a kind of a propensity for it. What we make of that, I don't know. It used to be argued strongly that this meant that Mark was original, early, and that Matthew then and Luke omit these Aramaic words because their readers won't understand them. But since Mark often translates them, I don't think that, I mean, I think that's about as convincing as what happens when you get a beginning preacher who likes to sprinkle Greek words in his text. You know. Not that I would accuse the evangelist St. Mark of showing off or something, but yeah. But it is a little unusual. So, Adam?
For the last one,
yes?
As far as trying to emphasize the errors aspect of it and the action there, can you make it progressive? Like something that's going on for sake of means rather than complete action?
No, I think, again, Jesus is just quoting the psalm, right? Which is why it's in a question form. This, if you haven't gotten this question in Bible class, you will. Pastor, didn't Jesus know what was going on? You know, why did you forsake me? He's quoting the psalm, and the psalm is in the form of a question. That's why it's a question. See? No, I think just an aorist, you know, you could, it's normally translated, why have you forsaken me in English? That's okay. You could also, why did you forsake me? I think he's just reflecting the language of the psalm. So, yeah, good.
Do you think he's intentionally trying to refer people to that psalm, and should we read this sort of a part of the whole and applying that whole psalm, or just take kind of the words, just these short sessions of five?
Yeah. The question is, should we take Christ's citation here as an invitation to read the whole psalm of 22? Well, I think sometimes that's happening. What I've actually heard about this passage before, you didn't say this, Ben, but people have actually said that what Jesus is really doing is expressing his confidence that God will vindicate him, because Psalm 22 ends on a confident note, you know. France, I think, has a good comment on this. He says, this is a singularly awkward way to do something, you know. So you know, that's often confidently stated. I'm a little cautious. I think that sometimes, and what you do is you search around in the context to see if there are some features, for instance, what's going on later in Psalm 22, are they matched up, you know, with what's going on in Matthew 27, right? It would be really neat, for instance, if in chapter 28, Jesus met the women and said, hello, and then, which is what he says, right, chairata, hello, right, greatest hello in history. And he then quoted the end of Psalm 22 or something, right? I think this is really dark. I think he's declaring that this, what he said, I will strike the shepherd. This is the vicarious satisfaction. Yeah. And Pat, your comment earlier, this is the Son being abandoned by the Father. This is our salvation. Right. Yeah. As one of the Catholic liturgies says, behold the wood of the cross on which is hung our salvation. O come, let us adore him. Everybody's clear there should be a sense of mystery and holy fear in the church. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Yeah. Okay. Great stuff. Oh man, we got to hurry. I apologize. Josh, take us through 47 and maybe 48.
Okay.
There's lots of participles here.
And one of those standing.
You mean certain ones of those standing?
Yeah.
That's what I thought you meant. Yeah. Tines, right?
And
plural.
One
good.
Of those standing there after hearing.
Good. Good.
And immediately one of them, running and getting his sponge, filled it with vinegar and putting it on a reed, offered it to him.
Mm-hmm. Good. Give me a nice groovy translation for epotizen at the end there. It's an imperfect. How did you render it again? Was giving it?
Yeah, we're offering.
Yeah, that's fine. We're offering. Yeah, that works. I withdraw the question. What are you going to do with all these participles in 48, Josh? We've got dramon, labon, plesas, perithes, blah, 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 blah.
I'm just
going to
dump them all into a sentence.
I agree. Fits the pattern. You know, it's just he did this and did this and did this, and he was giving to him a drink. Good. Mark, you can easily take the hati there as recitative again, if you want. They were saying, quote, this one is calling Elijah. Elijah already came and they did whatever they wanted to him. Immediately, da-da-da-da-da. Good. Long sentence, attendant circumstance, participles, easy enough. Okay. 49, Troy, and 50, please.
Okay. But the rest said, and I had trouble with this, I could call this my Beatles translation, let him be.
Okay, okay, good.
Let us see if Elijah is coming, and then for the purpose of saving him.
Hoo-hoo, nice.
And again, Jesus cried out in a loud voice, and he let go of the Spirit.
Okay, good. Yep, so the remaining were saying... Yeah, this is odd. Office followed by a subjunctive. It's kind of an idiom. It's like, hold on, let's see, or something like that. How did you... Yeah, no, that's good.
Okay.
It's the wrong number. It's aorist imperative active second singular. Office. It's the wrong number. It's kind of an idiom. Okay. So, right. Yeah, Anthony?
Well, I'm just wondering, in light of that, imperative for this guy to stop or whatever we're doing, then it seems like it would be better to take the previous imperfect of 48 as conjunctive, so that he did get the...
Tried to give him a drink?
Yeah.
Yeah, I had thought of that as well. Yeah, I think...
I never really see that.
That's why we teach you Greek. So, right? Yeah, I had a note on this aphes. It's in BDAG, actually, the lexicon. It's just kind of paired with the subjunctive, especially the hortatory. It means it's kind of like, come on, let's do this, or something like that. So, but it does seem grammatically awkward. But Anthony, I had actually in my own head translated epotizen as a connative imperfect, right? Tried to give him a drink. Let's see if, or in indirect questions like this, A can be translated whether, but if works as well. What do you call that? Let us see. What kind of subjunctive? Hortatory subjunctive, right? Let's see if Elijah is coming. And now this is very rare, but Troy is, I think, exactly right. The sosone is a future participle in predicate position, and it expresses purpose. In order to save him. Again, there's about eight examples in the New Testament. Wallace counted them, of course. You know. But it's much more common in older Greek. But you certainly don't see it very often, and it expresses purpose in order to save him. And Jesus, again, maybe attendant circumstances, right? Cried out, native means, and released the Spirit. I don't think to make much of that. In John, you would probably make more, given John's nature as a kind of a double-layered narrative. But we'll come back to it. And now we're going to press on. Carl, 51 and 52. And no, I can't answer all the questions about these verses. We'll answer them next time. All of them, I promise.
And behold, the curtain of the temple was torn from above to below into two, and the earth was shaken, and the rocks were split. And the tombs were opened, and many bodies of holy people having been asleep were raised.
yeah. You know. Come in. Oh, Uncle Reuben. I thought you were dead. Yeah. This is the only reference. Carl, you're doing such a great job. You want to carry us through the 53?
Okay.
And?
They came out of the tombs.
Yeah, that's right.
After his resurrection. And went into the holy city and were manifested to many.
Very good. Yeah. I think another meaning for M. Fonidzo is to scare the pants off of. Or the toga or whatever they were wearing. Yeah, so I heard an attendant circumstance for that participle, right? That works. They went out of the tombs. The sequence is a little confused. What does after his resurrection go with? Does it go with the participle or does it go with the main verb? And the answer is you can't prove it either way. Maybe we're not supposed to know. Grammatically, it's not too hard. I think this is the judgment day. I think that what happens to Jesus is the judgment day. And this shows it, all these signs. So we'll come back to that. And finally, verse 54. Adam, finish it off, man.
And the centurion, and those standing with him, guarding him in his witness, in the earthquake, and greatly fearing the things, they said, "Truly this man is the Son of God."
Okay, give me that greatly fearing part again, Adam. My ears are plugged, and I honestly didn't hear you. I'm sorry.
Greatly fearing, and I translated the phenomena, the happening.
Okay. Okay.
They said, "Truly this man is the Son of God."
So great, and they greatly feared these things. Huh? I've never heard it translated that way before. I don't see why it couldn't be. Right, right, right. Well, I think it's normally taken, again, I don't think it's impossible, taking it as a second object after idontes, after the participle, seeing the earthquake and the things that had happened. See? But actually, the passive of phobeomai can actually come to be transitive and mean to fear something. So, again, it's not normally rendered that way, but I don't see any reason why it couldn't be. And they feared these things greatly and said. No, they feared the things that had happened. Right? Yeah, no, that's very good. Interesting. I don't know if it's right, but you're paying attention. I mean, that's very good. Guarding the Jesus when they saw the earthquake. How do you want to take that participle again, Adam? When temporal, causal, I think. Idontes, and then we'll be done. Or just attendant circumstance? Or?
Temporal.
Yeah, after they had seen. Uh-huh, that would work. Causal would work. It would make a tighter connection, right? Right? So... truly, this one was the Son of God. People ask the historical question, could a Roman centurion have known that much about Jesus? In Matthew, I think the answer is yes. As Dr. Okamoto cited a bunch of Matthew texts in his... you guys, if you were able to be in chapel, I mean, you were probably tracking better than the average seminarian because Okamoto was just kind of flitting around the entire gospel there. And... yeah, so somehow it's given to the centurion.